Hey, Chris Garlock here. This week's show is from our archives and is one of my favorites. As Black Lives Matter protests continue to spread across the country this summer, we've got stories of mass uprisings from our past. Labor historian Joe McCartan discusses the 1934 San Francisco longshoreman strike, which spread into a four-day general strike. Then, Donna Haverty Stack tells us about the 1934 Minneapolis truckers strike. And union convention badges are the labor history object of the week, as Ben Blake takes another deep dive into the George Meany Labor Archives. Stay safe, keep cool, and, as always, keep making labor history. Here's the show.
This is a song about sticking together with your friends, your neighbors, and your loved ones. When you get tired of being pushed around, you get together. I said you get together! And you pull off this thing. You know what it's called? That's right. It's called the General Strike.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today. On this week's show, Why Do Workers Fight? Joe McCartan digs into this question in the 1934 San Francisco longshoreman strike, which spread into a four-day general strike and the Great Steel Strike of 1959.
The nature of humans, I think, is they like to have some control over their own destiny.
Donna Haverty Stack looks at the impact of another 1934 strike, this one by Minneapolis truckers, who are also the target of the Smith Act, the first peacetime sedition law passed since 1798.
If one line of struggle seems closed off, don't forget that there might be many more.
For this week's Labor History Object of the Week, old-time union convention badges, as curator Ben Blake takes another deep dive into the George Meany Labor Archives.
So it's very elaborate, has an American flag as a ribbon.
Plus, General Strike by DOA and Enough is Enough from Chumbawamba. So this week we're going to talk strikes and a little bit on a general strike, but we're going to talk about the things that workers and management fight over.
Sure, and how they fight.
And how they fight.
You know, what are the rules of the fight? So, there are a couple of interesting things we can talk about, anniversaries that occur this week on July 15th and 16th. First, let's start with July 16th of 1934. This was a day that saw a spread of a general strike in San Francisco that began on the city's docks among longshoremen, workers led then by Harry Bridges, an Australian-born activist who built the union called the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, one of the most significant, powerful, democratic, and militant unions that emerged in the 1930s, and built, against strong opposition. And this is what happened on that date of 1934. The shipping companies would not recognize the longshore union, and so the longshoremen struck, and then other workers began to strike in sympathy with the longshore strike, and it became a general strike in San Francisco, violence broke out in the strike, and a couple strikers were in fact killed during the general strike.
It's interesting because in San Francisco, I actually took a, they do a month-long labor fest there. In fact, it's where we got our idea for the DC Labor Fest. And I took a tour as part of that labor fest talking about the general strike. And a lot of people don't really think of San Francisco as a union town, but it actually has a really strong history.
You know, people ought to, because it actually has been a very strong union town since the late 19th and early 20th centuries, especially the building trades. Mm-hmm. They became very powerful in San Francisco. A friend and colleague, Michael Kazin, wrote a book about San Francisco building trades called The Barons of Labor, about how those building trades unions were built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and how they really became a power center for workers. But the building trades were one thing. You know, there you had skilled workers like carpenters and electricians and bricklayers who it was more possible to organize the labor market for and to get even recalcitrant employers to go along with recognizing a union, often after a fight. But San Francisco basically became a union town, in contrast to, say, Los Angeles, which was an open shop or anti-union town in the early 20th century. San Francisco was strongly unionized in its building trades, but lesser skilled workers on the waterfront, for example, were not organized well in San Francisco, and that's where the fight was in the 1930s, was with the industrial workers of the 30s, and including workers like the warehouse and longshore workers. So that's the fight that began. It's sometimes called the big strike in San Francisco, which was underway in 1934. And so that strike was actually led to conflict, what was called Bloody Thursday, when the police tried to open up the port and break the strike. Struggle took place between the police and the strikers. Shots were fired.
Yeah, they did not.
They were tough.
But this was not like, you know, strikes today where people have these nice, you know, pickets and all these mm-hmm. rules. I mean, this was often pitched battle.
Oh yeah, yeah, and so one guy was shot and killed. Another guy was shot and seriously wounded. A third guy, who happened to be in the Cooks Union, was shot, but he later died.
I actually think there's a memorial to this down where Tux used to be.
Right. So this is the kind of conflict that often happened in the 30s. Strikes that elicited a violent response often, on occasion people would die. 1934, the year of the San Francisco General Strike, was a year of big strikes around the country. The textile strike happened in September of that year, and about 400,000 workers from Maine down to Alabama walked out on strike in that strike. There was a Teamsters strike in Minneapolis. There was a strike in Toledo at the Autolite plant. In all of these settings, violence was happening. So
I'm just saying, actually, sorry, but I was just saying that actually in that Minneapolis trucker strike, they had a Bloody Friday. So you had a Bloody Friday.
There were a lot of bloody, you know, there was a bloody just about every day of the week during this year of labor conflict.
We're tired of working, not working for nothing. We are one. What we got in common, all we need is our brain. Come on, we're gonna shake. Everything is not alright, and there's no end in sight. You call in what you like. Come on, stand up for your right. Stand up, stand and unite. It's time for a general strike. Stand up, stand and unite. For a general strike, we've been out for
And that reminds us, like, how, you know, brutal and sometimes bare-knuckle the battle for worker rights was in this period of union formation in the 30s. In the end, the Wagner Act was passed a year later, and it legalized workers' rights to strike. It ensured that they had certain rights. You started to see this kind of bloody conflict become less common. However, you know, there was still a struggle. Over time, however, between 1935, the Wagner Act, and the post-World War II period, a kind of transformation took place. Again, not without struggle, but by the time the country emerged from World War II, unions had pretty successfully organized in the industrial centers of the country and on the nation's ports. So you had a strong international longshore and warehouse union established in San Francisco and up and down the West Coast. You had the auto workers union, you had a steel workers union. There was a strike wave after World War II ended. It began in the late 1945, stretched into 1947, really. A lot of strikes happened in that period. There was a big difference between those strikes and the strikes of 1934 or any previous period, and that was they were not any longer over do the workers have a union, does the employer recognize the union. In those settings, the strikes of 1946, they were never about trying to uproot the union or break it. They were about what will the contract be.
How much? How much money are we going to get? Much? What's our benefits?
Right. And so a transformation took place. A transformation that, you know, indicated a period of relative stability in the labor-management relationship. Some have called it a labor-management truce. I don't think that that is ever the proper term, because it was a continuous struggle and conflict.
Maybe a ceasefire.
Not even a ceasefire, but like not a nuclear war. Okay, we're not going to try to nuke you and destroy your organizations, but we'll continue to fight. And the 1950s were actually the most strike-prone decade in American history. More workers went out on strike in the 1950s than in any previous decade. Or
it's fascinating because it's really not a time.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's the 30s always because of the brutality, I guess.
Yeah, we think about the 50s as a time of like political placidness and like the Eisenhower years.
For the whole McCarthy thing.
Of course. But we think about Eisenhower, I like Ike, the country was prosperous, you know, the middle class was growing, suburbia was rising. What do people have to strike about? Well, they were striking constantly. In fact, that whole prosperity wave and how widely prosperity was shared was part of the struggle. Workers said, we want a piece, and they got a piece. They got a piece by fighting, by staging these strikes. And one place where strikes had become routinized pretty much was in the steel industry. Like clockwork, they happened beginning in 1946, boom. And then on a regular basis. And it was always a question of, what are we gonna get? And in both the steel and the auto industry, the unions were making significant gains.
How long were contracts in those days?
Generally 2 years, sometimes a little bit longer. In 1950, the auto workers concluded a 5-year contract deal. It was called the Treaty of Detroit, and because peace for 5 years, no conflict for 5 years.
Because a 2-year contract is almost like a congressperson. I mean, as soon as you're elected, you got to start, you know, campaigning again.
Unions didn't want long contracts.
No, I wouldn't.
Because what they wanted was, let's see how it looks in a couple of years.
Right.
So for the most part, there was pressure to not do that. What happened in the steel industry is that the steel union and the steel makers, it kind of develop this kind of pattern. And they would struggle and tussle on a regular basis. There would be a strike. They would settle it. But then came 1959, and that was a really big year. And that's the second anniversary. We talked about July 16th marking the spread of the San Francisco general strike. July 15th of 1959 marked the beginning of a walkout of mammoth proportions, a 116-day strike by 500,000 steel workers.
Wow.
It was huge. Both in the number of people who walked out, but even more importantly, how long they stayed on strike. And it was a remarkable event. And, you know, it's worth remembering what that event signified.
Well, because it wasn't about, but it was just, I just am learning about this, yeah. But it wasn't about money.
It wasn't primarily about money. What the steelmakers wanted was the ability to reorganize the workplace, to eliminate jobs, basically. They contended that the union had fought for what the steelmakers called feather bedding, that is, like protecting jobs that were unnecessary. They thought that was cutting their profits. As the steelworkers saw it, this is a hard work. They worked in teams, and it was quite a complex industry on the shop floor and how it was organized. And workers worked in different settings in the mill, from the blast furnace to the rolling mill to other parts of the industry. And one of the things that had developed in the steelworker union was that its shop stewards had become really kind of like workplace lawyers on behalf of their workers. They all carried in their back pocket a copy of the contract. They knew what a worker could be asked to do, what they couldn't be asked to do, what their responsibilities were. You can't just move people around willy-nilly. What the union wanted was the ability to have a say over what workers could be asked to do and how many people work in a particular setting. Employers wanted to reorganize the workplace at will, and the workers said, we're not going to do that. What was at issue was a clause in the steelworker contract called Section 2B, and the employer wanted to rewrite it, and the union was like, we're not going to let you do that. You want to take total control of how you organize the workplace, but we want a say in that. We're not going to let you do it. And so the employer said, well, we'll starve you out then. Let's see how you feel about this after a month of no wages, or 2 months, or 3 months.
It was a real stare down.
It was a stare down.
Wow.
And what the powerful thing was that union stayed out 116 days. Nobody crossed the picket line.
Half a million
people. Nobody crossed the picket line. And it should be said at the same time, the steel employers didn't try to break the strike by bringing in strike breakers either. They weren't trying to roll back the clock to 1934. But they thought they could starve the union out. They couldn't. The union would not budge. It held. And to the point where the president had to intervene. Eisenhower,
the president of the country
had to intervene. Eisenhower had to say, well, we can't have, this is like the basic product, steel, that's behind our auto industry and almost everything else in the country is not being produced. It's starting to harm the whole economy. You all need to come to an agreement. And in the end, an agreement was reached, but it was reached on the union's terms, basically. They did not budge. They protected that clause. And basically what they agreed to was a compromise that you can only reorganize the job if you introduce some new technology that justifies it in a given setting. You can't just come in willy-nilly and start eliminating jobs. So here's what they were striking over, basically, is will we have work? Will our children have work? And we're going to fight for work. And we're going to not allow you to push us into an idea that work should become scarce, that you're going to start to take work away from us, unless you can justify it. If you can show by introducing new technology that certain jobs are unnecessary, we'll allow it. And in fact, the union was never as anti-technology, as anti-progress as its enemies claimed. It said, yeah, we'll go with that. But you're not just going to willy-nilly eliminate jobs.
Well, and I wanted to raise two questions. I think they're probably related, maybe even different sides of the same coin. Because I would imagine that, especially when we saw what happened to the steel industry, and I mean, a lot of these basic industries, which have been, you know, it's not that jobs were lost, that jobs were sent to other countries where they could be done, you know, less expensive. But I'm thinking, you know, in recent years of the food and commercial workers and attempts by supermarkets. This is something we can all relate to. Supermarket,
right.
You go to the supermarket, you go to Giant, you go to Safeway,
right.
And you've got these self-checkout, lanes, which mm-hmm. of course I never go to because I object to being turned into my own checkout person.
Right.
Although I'd be happy to pay dues to Local 400.
Right.
But it seems to me that it's the same issue, right? And the union has fought this because, you know, they're eliminating supermarkets are eliminating jobs. But what I think the argument has been is, you know, if you're not nimble, if you're not able to implement technologies, then, you know, you may wind up, costing everybody's jobs.
Right.
So can you talk about, you know, what's really going on there? And then the other question I wanted to address is, you know, the question of control over work, right, which seems to me to be an even more fundamental question. I mean, they don't come to the workers and say, you know, we need to be more efficient steel mill, or we need to be more efficient in the supermarket. Let's all work together to see
right.
how we can best accomplish it. Because, yeah. By the way, you guys do this, and maybe
right.
you might have some ideas about
it. Right. That's right. I mean, they wanted total managerial prerogative over how to reorganize and eliminate jobs.
Taylorism.
It wasn't like, let's work together to make these places more efficient, which the union was prepared to do. Because after all, you know, it's no good for steelworkers if, you know, their mills become increasingly inefficient and don't compete well with the steel mills of other countries.
Which is what happened.
Well, in part, because what happened over time is that U.S. steelmakers stopped reinvesting and modernizing their mills and increasingly started to use them as cash cows. And over time, you know, that took a toll. But a lot of it was managerial decision-making about priorities and prioritizing stock dividends, say, above plowing money back in to reinvest. In a sense, the union's compromise in 1952 was an incentive for employers to introduce new technologies, because they could then justify a reorganization of certain jobs. But in some cases, you know, steel makers were more intent on just making more profits faster now, rather than reinvesting in their mills for the long run. And so, you know, between 1959 and 1977, you start to have the aging of our steel mill infrastructure and growing foreign competition. And it's in September 19th of 1977 that the Youngstown Sheet and Tube plant is just suddenly shuttered. And a lot of people point to that date as the beginning of deindustrialization in a serious way in what had been the industrial heartland of the country. But Youngstown Sheet and Tube was being bled dry before it was closed, by having been acquired by a conglomerate which was milking it as a cash cow rather than putting money back into it. Workers had no warning there that they were going to lose their jobs. The fight in 1959, then, this 116-day fight, was really a fight about the whole concept of solidarity. Mm-hmm. There's a great book on this strike. It's by a labor educator named Jack Metzger, whose dad was a steel worker and a union steward in the union. And Jack calls his book Striking Steel, Solidarity Remembered. And what he remembers about the strike, he was a young teenager when it happened, is just how, you know, tight his father and the other steel workers were through these 116 days and how disciplined they were. They knew this strike was coming. They saved money for it. A lot of them, you know, said, well, we're going to go on extended fishing trips and stuff like that. We're going to wait it out. They were disciplined, but they knew that they were in a fight not just for themselves, but for their communities, their sons, and that they thought, like Jack, that he'd end up in the mill one day. And they hung together around that. But over time, of course, the ability of American workers to hang together around this question of the control of work and jobs, and will they be protected for the people come after them, gets eroded and eroded. Not just by managerial decision making, but also by national policy, because this country never developed an industrial policy like, say, Germany, which said, basically, the Germans said, we need to have some factory jobs. We're going to do things that support companies like Volkswagen and Mercedes-Benz to produce high-end automobiles. We're going to provide a setting where there's an interest in that. We're going to pursue trade policies that help those kinds of companies. In the U.S., basically in the post-war era, our policymakers, for the most part, pursued policies of free trade that were, in some cases, at the expense of the American worker, and in which the U.S. viewed questions of international trade as ways to, you know, build its Cold War alliance, but often by shortchanging, you know, American workers by not really having policies in place that had a national strategy around, well, how do we keep, you know, a certain number of really high quality factory jobs in this country? We never had a national policy about that. A lot of people look back at the 1959 steel strike, if they're anti-union, and they say, see, you know, that's why these jobs went away. Those guys were stubborn. They wanted too much. I think that's a completely wrong way of understanding this. If you read Jack Metzger's book, it's hard to sustain that argument once you know the details of this. Because actually, they were ready to compromise on things to produce progress and efficiency in their mills, but they wanted a plan and they wanted some guarantees that jobs wouldn't just be wiped out.
But going to, you were just talking about, for example, Germany, and we've talked about this before, that the big difference is that in Germany you have people from the union, you know, workers sitting on the board,
right?
I mean, is there any, are there any workers sitting on the boards, you know, in this country? I mean, not that I know of.
No. So that didn't happen in the U.S. What happened in Germany was co-determination that, you know, the German government actually said, you know, it makes sense for workers to have a say in what companies do because they're an important part of all of this. And in fact, if what the companies are doing undercuts workers, that's not good. That never happened in the U.S. You know, we talked about how things progressed, say, from the 1934, you know, San Francisco strike to the 1959 strike, where strikes became routinized by then and workers had a lot of clout, and the steel workers used it in that setting. In between was an important strike. I mentioned that post-war strike wave in the auto industry in 1945-46. The UAW struck General Motors. They didn't demand a seat on the board, but they did demand some say over managerial decisions. One of the things they demanded was that the company not raise the price of its automobiles. And the union claimed it could easily meet its demands without raising the price. The company fought that.
Sure they did.
They basically said a precedent is at stake here. You're trying to dictate to us how to run our business.
Right.
We're not going to have that.
Right. You stay in your lane.
We're managers. We make those decisions. The union's theory was if you don't raise the price and you increase our wages, basically we're going to buy more cars, and us buying more cars is going to spread the wealth, because when we have more money and we're buying your cars and we're also going down the street and spending money in our neighbor's business, they're buying your cars too. We don't want you to pass on every increase to the consumer. We want you to take a piece out of your own profit, because you know what? In the long run, it's actually going to be helpful to you. You'll have a growing and thriving business, and we'll have a post-war economy that spreads the wealth more widely. They had a real, intense fight over that, and in that case, the union gave in. They took a wage increase. They gave up on the demand to have a say over prices. So in a sense, those two strikes also, the auto worker strike in 1945-46 and then the steel worker strike in 59, they also illustrate this great battle that was underway for power and control. And while things had become routinized, the auto workers were never in danger of being broken in that strike against GM, the same with the steel workers in 59. But what they were fighting about were big, big questions about who gets what and what kind of economy are we going to have and whose interests will be protected within it. And those were the nature of the fights that happened then. The sad thing now from our perspective looking back is that, we're in a time and place where workers don't feel like they have the ability to strike. We've just recently seen this past spring the teachers walk out and strike. In a lot of cases they had no legal right to do that in West Virginia or other places where they did it. They did it anyway. But private sector U.S. workers these days, they're afraid to do this, even if they're in a union. Unions are, in this current environment, reluctant to strike. They don't feel like they have the clout that they had in the 50s or after World War II. And they're not able to use collective action, at least in recent years, to put the big questions on the table the way unions did then.
Yeah.
Except with exception of these teachers, they put big questions on the table by striking. How are our schools going to be funded? By whom? What's a fair wage for working in these schools? What's a fair wage of being, a state worker in West Virginia? Who should benefit from tax cuts? And should we continue to cut taxes while we're starving our public services? They put big questions on the table by acting collectively in a way that workers haven't done for a long time in the country. They were doing that in the post-war era. They haven't been doing it much of late, which makes those strikes really interesting.
Yeah, and I guess sort of my final observation would be that, it seems like from the employer's point of view, they keep trying to, tamp this down and squelch this. And, even when they appear to be successful, it almost seems like it's doomed because, workers in whatever sector, we want to have something to say, about her, how much we get paid, what the nature of the work, all kinds of things. We don't want to just go to work. Oops.
The nature of humans, I think, is they like to have some control over their own destiny. They like to be able to have some say in things. They don't like to be
treated like widgets.
Yes, treated right? like machines or pieces of property, or you know, people who can be dealt with in any way. People, you know, like to be treated with some amount of dignity, and having dignity means, you know, not being subject entirely to the will of others. It's having some sense of personal autonomy. Right now, it's hard for people to feel that in a lot of settings. They don't feel it in a lot of settings, and they don't feel either at this moment the means to come together collectively to do something about that, at least for the most part. The teachers kind of have showed people, actually, if you do come together, you might be able to do something about how you feel. That could spread. We'll see.
All right. Let's hope so. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Chris.
Stand up, stand and unite. It's time for a generous child. Stand up, stand and unite. It's time for a general strike. Stand up, stand and unite.
Next, Labor History Today's Patrick Dixon talks with Donna Haverty Stack, professor of history at Hunter College, about another 1934 strike, this one by Minneapolis truckers, who were also the target of the Smith Act, the first peacetime sedition law passed since 1798. Professor Haverty Stack is the author of America's Forgotten Holiday, May Day and Nationalism, 1867 to 1960, and the co-editor of Rethinking U.S. Labor History, Essays on the Working Class Experience, 1756 to 2009. Here's Patrick.
Thanks, Jerry!
Okay, so welcome to Labor History Today. Thanks for joining us, Donna.
Thanks so much.
So today we're talking about Local 544 of the Teamsters in Minneapolis. Now, this is a local that's most famous for the 1934 truckers' strike. I think many people have probably seen some of the iconic images of members fighting with police in the streets. It's also a union that's famous for the rise of the Socialist Workers' Party into the leadership of that local. Can you tell us, how did they come to lead that union?
Yeah, so actually, during the 1934 strikes, the local was known as Local 574. Don't have to get into the nitty-gritty of how that changes numbers. It does eventually become Local 544 after the strike. At the time of the strikes, the leadership of the union, the president and the vice president, were not themselves members of what would become the Socialist Workers' Party. Of course, that emerged in 1938. But you're right that there were Trotskyists who were working in the field as truckers who were active in the strike committee. So men like Vincent Dunn, Carl Skoglund, Farrell Dobbs, They were working in that industry. They were close to the leadership of Local 574, and they were very good organizers and were key to organizing these strikes, as you mentioned, in 1934, the strike in the coal yard in February, and then the truckers' strikes in May and July of 1934.
Up until 1940, is it fair to say they're quite effective leaders in creating quite a potent local?
Yes, very much so. And part of this came from the individual backgrounds of these men, their lives as workers. Several of them had roots in the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, men like Vincent Dunn, and they learned some of the organizing skills in those experiences. And also they brought their ideological understanding of worker struggle as Trotskyists to their organizing. They understood the union to be a place where workers could represent themselves and needed to rely on themselves and needed solidarity to fight against capitalism ultimately, but they also realized that not all the workers in the ranks shared their Trotskyism, and they were very realistic and practical in fighting for immediate gains with a longer-term goal in mind. And in 1934, in Minneapolis, the notorious open shop town, merely getting the union recognized was an enormous victory. And that was the first thing they had to do, along with fighting for increases in wages. And again, as Trotskyists, they had a view of industrial unionism, not the more traditional craft unionism, which Local 574 had been up until that point. They wanted to organize not just the truckers, but the inside workers as well, the warehouse workers, and that was one of the issues during the strikes that summer. They were successful in moving in that direction and getting support among not only the members of 574, which they grew that union. At the time of the coal strike in February, there were maybe 300 folks in that union. By April, it jumped to 3,000, and then they gained another 7,000 members by May. So they really grew the ranks of that union over the course of the struggle that summer, and they also got the support from other workers in the city, sympathy strikes on the part of the building trades and the cab drivers and others to make sure that nothing moved out of the warehouses. And so that came again from their skill of their previous experience as workers, but I think also from their political understanding of the situation.
Now, a lot of people have looked at the truckers' strike as, I suppose, part of this sort of labor conflict and the prelude to New Deal labor reform. But you found in 1940, in the early World War II era, Europe's at war, the United States has not yet entered. The story of this local continues, and you have one of the most interesting chapters, perhaps. And that starts with the Smith Act, named after Democratic Representative Howard Smith from Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what the Smith Act is, please?
Yes. So the Smith Act was officially known as the Alien Registration Act. As you said, it was sponsored by Howard Smith in the House. It was passed in 1940, and it was the first peacetime sedition law since 1798. The United States had the Espionage Act that was passed in 1917, sort of more famously used during the Red Scare, during the First World War, and in the period of the first Red Scare against folks who criticized the war. But that was a wartime measure and could only be implemented in times of war. There was a clamoring among various folks on the political right, in the military, to have a peacetime sedition law. And that clamoring came about 1938, 1939 in the context of what has been called the fifth column fear. There was tremendous anxiety over foreign-inspired internal subversives, be they German spies or communist spies. And there were some actual cases of German spy rings that were rather inconsequential but got a lot of sensational reporting and fueled that fear. And that was coupled with the context of what historians referred to as the Little Red Scare, which began in 1939 with the announcement of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, when the communist parties around the globe, which had been opposed to the spread of fascism, quickly turned and their position and were no longer supporting the war because of the pact. That contributed to the suspicion of communism and communist movements, particularly in the United States, where there was no love lost for communism from the get-go. So those two moments, the fifth column fear and the Little Red Scare, kind of provide the backdrop to the passage then of this peacetime sedition law, which made it illegal to interfere with the draft, to try to undermine the morale of the armed forces in peacetime. And so this law is passed, as I said, in 1940, and circling back to our Trotskyists and to Local 544 in particular, they become the first target of this law, the first time it's used, was against the members of the Socialist Workers Party, 15 of whom are also members of Local 544. And so there's sort of a double context to the case that emerges in the summer of 1941. One is targeting the leadership of the Socialist Workers Party, in large part because the Trotskyists remained opposed to the war, unlike the communist CPUSA. And they were seen as undermining the war effort in their opposition to the war. But in particular, the Trotskyists, the Teamsters, were targeted for a number of reasons. From the government's point of view, there was an anxiety, given the history of the 34 strikes, that a union that had influence over truck drivers in the Midwest, that had organized not only Minneapolis, but several of the Midwestern states, could perhaps interfere with the war preparedness program. America was not yet in the war, but Roosevelt was increasingly putting America on war preparedness footing by 1941, Lend-Lease, and so forth. And so there was this anxiety that they were opposed to war, they're influential in this union, they could snap their fingers and suddenly shut down trucking in the center of the country and disrupt the war effort. Right? That was the government's perception. But there also was a deeper backstory to internal union strife in Local 544, a rank-and-file group of anti-communist workers who had a variety of reasons why they wanted to oust the Trotskyist leadership from Local 544, which at this point did include Vincent Dunn and others who were now leaders of the union. A lot of this was ideological, political. Some of it was personal grudges, a desire to wrest control of the union for themselves. And they actually started cooperating with the FBI. The FBI, because, again, of the government's perception of this possible threat, had begun to investigate Local 544 as early as August of 1940. I found evidence of them recruiting informants, sending in undercover agents to infiltrate the union, and they became close bedfellows with this rank-and-file anti-communist movement in the union that contributed to the unfolding of what becomes the decision of the Department of Justice to indict these individuals for a violation of the Smith Act in the summer of 1941.
So rather than being purely a raid on the part of FBI on this unsuspecting local, there's actually cooperation going on. Now,
yes.
I understand defense attorneys, after the application of what's known as the clear and present danger test, it seems that they're essentially arguing that that their clients aren't going to start a revolution anytime soon, that they're not that serious a threat, but that the government responds by referring to their own literature, by referring to Marxist classics.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a fascinating part about the trial, which begins in October of 41. You're right, the defense team led by Albert Goldman, who was himself one of the defendants from the party in New York, they have this very delicate line to walk because on the one hand they want to argue that the Smith Act is, ultimately they want to argue the Smith Act is unconstitutional, but they can't do that at the level of the trial. So they try to say that they do not pose a clear and present danger to the point where this kind of restriction on their speech, because the Smith Act made it illegal to advocate the violent overthrow of the government. You didn't have to prove overt acts. It was mere advocacy. So speech was at the core of the case. The First Amendment was at the core of the case. And so the defense team was using the clear and present danger test, which was first articulated by Oliver Wendell Holmes in the Schenck decision in 1919 with respect to the Espionage Act, in which a Socialist Party member, Charles Schenck, was found guilty for distributing pamphlets urging people to resist the draft. He couldn't deny that he did that. It was obvious he did that. He challenged the constitutionality of that law. The court disagreed with him, and it, for the first time, articulated that free speech is not absolute. You can put limits on speech. It depends on the context in which it takes place. The famous shouting fire in a crowded theater metaphor, right, that Holmes uses there to articulate if there is a clear and present danger, which damages that the Congress has the right to prevent, of dangers that the Congress has the right to prevent, then you can, it can implement restrictions on speech. So that set the standard. It was initially used to restrict speech. Holmes, a few months later, in the Abrams dissent, another Espionage Act case, uses the test to dissent from the majority, which upheld the conviction of Abrams, who was an anarchist, and several other anarchists. Holmes says, no, look, they were not a clear and present danger. He sort of belittles them and says that they were not that much of a threat. So it's in that vein, as you were articulating your question, that the SWP defense is picking up on the clear and present danger test. But there's a catch-22, because precisely, if you're going to use that framework as your defense, inherently you have to kind of show how impotent you are. And that becomes a problem because the socialist workers want to use the courtroom to defend their ideas, to defend their right to speak their ideas, and to defend that they are revolutionaries. So then they get into this whole line where they say, we are not advocating violence, we're predicting it down in the future. So that it's because another part of the weight of clear and present is the gravity and the imminency, right? So they can say, we are not a grave threat, we are only a few thousand members in this large country, and we are not a present threat, we are not an immediate threat, because the violence that we're not advocating violence, we are predicting that when the revolution comes, it's the capitalists that are going to bring the violence to bear, and workers need to be ready to defend themselves. So this becomes their line of attack, becomes not very successful. 18 of the original 29 defendants were found guilty of violating the Smith Act and subsequently served jail terms after the Eighth Circuit Court upheld their convictions and the Supreme Court refused to review the case. So at that point, essentially allowing that Smith Act to stand, and the Smith Act then becomes a major weapon used by the federal government during the second Red Scare, the McCarthy period.
It sounds like they had a complicated case to make in unfavorable circumstances. So
yes.
Is this case also important in understanding how Labour would go on to respond to the pressures that were placed upon it during the early years of the Cold War?
Yes. I mean, certainly the immediate fallout for Local 544 in Minneapolis was significant. The federal case was just one of many layers of attack launched at those Trotskyist leaders of the union, and they eventually, well, quite quickly, within a year or so, lose control of their local that had actually broken away from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters and affiliated with the CIO, which they argue is one of the reasons why they may have been targeted by the federal government, because Daniel Tobin, the head of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, reached out to President Roosevelt denouncing this local as a threat, the leaders of that local as a threat, a national security threat. And so the danger of having the federal government intervene in labor affairs on the grounds of national security was one that was very much communicated to these leaders of that local, and they eventually lose control of that local. And that also contributed to their ability during the trial and in the years that they were appealing the original conviction to get support of more progressive unionists who were anxious of that happening too. Now, Roosevelt could claim, I was invited in by Daniel Tobin. Of course, I wouldn't let my Justice Department go in because he wanted to maintain the labor vote. But more progressive unionists were very anxious about what that might have meant, what that writing might have been on the wall, right? And they suffer that first. Later, the Smith Act is used more directly towards radical political leaders, but that contributes to, again, that kind of multiple pronged attack on the labor left during the Red Scare years, the second Red Scare years, so that more either straight up anti-communist workers and union leaders, or more sort of practical and anxious union leaders, will come together and, for example, start supporting bans on communist leadership in their own unions. And, you know, most famously, the CIO doing this in 1949 as it's under pressure from, you know, the various restrictions of the Taft-Hartley Act, most famously the section that requires them to sign affidavits, leaders to sign affidavits swearing that they are not communists. The Smith Act is in the background sort of stalking and providing the broader context of pressure that contributes to unions purging themselves, I guess is a way you could see it. In addition to ultimately eventually decapitating the CPUSA when it is used against those leaders in 1949 in the federal court in New York City, and is that in that case, the Dennis case, named after Eugene Dennis, the Supreme Court does review and does uphold the law, the Smith Act, in 1951. And again, context is key. 1951, tense time in the Cold War, on the heels of the Soviets securing the bomb, of China falling to communism, of the Korean War breaking out, of the beginnings of the Rosenberg case. You know, this was not a good time to be a communist, right, and to come up on trial under the Smith Act, right? And so in that case, going back to the clear and present danger language, Chief Justice Vinson says, you know, gravity is significant enough to uphold this, and they are a grave threat. There were two dissents in that case. Justice Douglas says they're not a grave threat. He's famous. They're miserable merchants of unwanted ideas whose wares remain unsold. You know, they're the most well-known and harassed fifth column that anybody's ever known. This is ridiculous, you know, but he was in the minority, as was Justice Black, who said, really kind of called it out and said, you know, in calmer times, his famous language, in calmer times, we would look at this and realize that these people are not a threat. But he's really recognizing the pressures the justices were under in the moment of the Cold War. So as of 51, the Smith Act is upheld, and it's not really until 1957 that the court will revisit the Smith Act again in the Yates decision. That case was named after Oleta Yates, who was a Communist Party leader in California, who with several other defendants was indicted under the Smith Act. She was one of the victims of the sort of second string. Once the Smith Act was upheld in Dennis, the Justice Department opened the floodgates into prosecutions of communists around the country, and Yates was one of them. It took a while for her case to make its way up through the courts, and it's not until 1957 that the Supreme Court reviews it, and at that time, it's a different context. Stalin is dead. The Korean War is over. There are changes in the court. It's now Earl Warren's court. And the court looks at this and says, you know, you need to have incitement to future action. There needs not just mere advocacy, there has to be incitement to action. And that becomes the standard and essentially defangs the Smith Act. The Smith Act was not declared unconstitutional. It's essentially defanged in Yates. And the Justice Department realizes that's a higher standard of evidence, and the prosecutions drop off, essentially dry up. So the Trotskyists, you know, they were the first to be targeted under this law. Their case is important, I think, for setting a precedent. In fact, the U.S. Attorney's strategy for trying the Dunn case, U.S. Attorney Victor Anderson, is used by the U.S. Attorney in the Dennis case. He actually gets the record and he uses it as his playbook. So there is very much a continuity there from 1941 through the Second Red Scare.
So just in the last minute or two we have left, since the 1990s, it seems as if the Justice Department hasn't treated Marxists as a serious threat to the United States. Since in 2001, obviously, their attention gets turned in another direction. But how is this case instructive in looking at the role of the state in regulating opposition today in rapidly and quickly evolving new political era?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, I've been rethinking my conclusion in my own book where I put a lot of faith in the courts and to kind of right past wrong decisions. I think I would put more emphasis on what I also say in the conclusion of my book on individuals and groups advocating and fighting for themselves, and I think that's something. I don't want to misrepresent Vincent Dunn and James Cannon and the others, but they certainly believed that workers had to rely on themselves and their own organizations to advance their interests. And so that I think there's an awareness of that. I think in the current era. There were some hopeful signs after 9/11, as you mentioned, obviously not the Patriot Act, but the court did push back in a few cases, checking the power of the president, checking, the power of the national security state. But, you know, it's hard to know. It's hard to know. This is where I say I'm a historian. I can study the past, and it's hard to predict the future. But that's where I would say, you know, if one line of struggle seems closed off, don't forget that there might be many more that could be refound and refound in the past. Yeah, we can go to the past to find some of those ways out.
This has been great to get you on. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
For this week's Labor History Object of the Week, archivist Ben Blake shows off some really cool old-time union convention badges deep in the George Meany Labor Archives at the University of Maryland College Park. All right, so what are we looking at here, Ben?
Well, we're looking at a variety of union badges from the late 19th century, early 20th century, and they're ribbons, very elaborate kind of ribbons and badges for different union events, in particular conventions.
All right, so why don't you describe this one? It's very elaborate.
So this is from the 21st Annual Convention of the AFL in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So it's a delegate's badge, and it has, it looks like, kind of shaped like the symbol or the seal of Pennsylvania. And it says 1901, and looks like it has a little image here. It looks like a railroad and maybe a steel mill. Within that symbol, there's maybe it's almost like it's not porcelain, but it's kind of like porcelain image. So it's very elaborate. Has an American flag as the ribbon background. So this would have been a badge that was worn by a delegate to the AFL convention of that year.
Well, and for those of us that have grown up, you know, with the sort of the plastic, you know, plastic badges with the lanyard around your neck, I mean, this is nothing like that. This is the keystone part you were describing, you know, that's embossed with 1901 is some sort of metal. And then, like you say, there's some porcelain there. The flag is actually, it looks like a mini flag made of actual cloth. And then it's quite fancy.
Definitely very elaborate, and it kind of shows that how the delegates, this would be something they would really want to save and treasure after the convention.
Oh yeah, and something. So and this, you know, not to say that that's not the case now, but you know, being selected as a delegate to a convention, this would have been a pretty big deal, right?
Oh, absolutely. And 1901, of course, that's right in the midst in Pennsylvania of organizing the coal fields. So it'd be a period of really important organizing going on.
Hmm. Now, in the these flat files, these are all organized, and does this stuff get to be displayed much, or is it pretty much more just for research?
Probably mostly for research. We have used some of the badges in our current exhibit in Hornbeck Library's gallery for Liberty, Justice, and Equality, Unions Making History in America. So we use some of the collections from our some of the ribbons and badges in our exhibit. But a lot of times they do stay back here in the stacks to preserve them, and they are available to researchers. We have an inventory. So if people are interested in coming in and taking a look at some of these badges, you can do that in the research room, our Maryland Reading Room here in the library.
Now, say somebody, you know, is cleaning out their, you know, their grandfather's attic, or maybe, you know, their local's storage space, and comes across something that they think might be of historic interest. What should they do?
Should definitely contact me, Ben Blake, at the University of Maryland. Best way to contact me is via email. So that's bblake12@umd.edu. And I get people calling me all the time about material that they'd like to donate. We just brought in a collection this week related to the AFL-CIO's work in creating Social Security, which obviously is very relevant now with the attacks on and attempts to privatize Social Security. So we get contacts all the time of people interested in donating things, and definitely encourage everyone to contact us. And if we can't find a good home for it here, there's other labor archives around the country that specialize in particular unions, and I can refer you to them.
Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough.
Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. Labor History sources include Today in Labor History from Union Communication Services. This week's labor music includes General Strike by DOA and Enough is Enough from Chumbawamba. As always, we hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of Labor History Today. Please spread the word by liking us on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to contribute a labor history item, and we hope you do, just shoot us an email at laborhistorytoday@gmail.com, and we'll send you details on how you can be part of the podcast. This has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history, and see you next week.
So black and white, you take a stand, and I'll try to defend. Are there the people and the children who are living in